Hey everyone, so recently I had an episode where I talk about how my wife and I bought and then renovated a home, and we created a budget template to track costs and hopefully limit our spending and stick to the plan as much as possible. So with that, I put out a budget template that you can go and get, and that was our most downloaded freebie from the Career Yak show thus far. So I'll put a link again in the show notes. Go check that out if you have any type of projects, or you're renovating a house, or you're doing even a smaller project and you have to see what it's going to cost and track costs throughout so that hopefully you don't overspend. Go check that out. Super helpful. Just wanted to remind everyone of that. And thanks for listening. Enjoy the show.
You got to knock on the door. You got to ask for the business. You got to introduce yourself. I mean, what's the worst thing that can happen? Is they say no. At least you had a chance to make an introduction, to begin a relationship, to drop off a business card, and to show some interest in their business.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Career Yak podcast. Today on my show, I have Mark McDaniel. Mark was my first boss in my first permanent role out of college, and we've remained good friends. We worked for about 2 years together, and we've stayed in touch since. And Mark currently serves as a VP with Ryder. He brings with him 4 decades worth of sales experience. And one fascinating story we talk about in depth is Mark's multi-million dollar deal he had, the details behind it, the proposal, the preparation it took, and how he ultimately moved past losing the deal. So, fascinating story. And whether you're in sales or not, I think there are a lot of valuable career insights that Mark has to share. So, I hope you enjoy, and here's our conversation. Today on the show, we have Mark McDaniel, who is a vice president of business development at Ryder. And just a quick context, Mark was my first permanent boss out of college when I started working in the trucking industry. And we worked together for over 2 years and got to know each other through just working day to day together. And definitely have a mutual respect for one another. I learned a lot from Mark and his wisdom, and he's had over 40 years in the trucking industry. So definitely want to glean from his experiences and see what we can learn about his career and how we can apply it to our own. So Mark, welcome to the show, and if you can just introduce yourself, what company you work for. Well, I did mention Ryder, but just a quick overview of what you do there and kind of give that snapshot of what your current role is.
Absolutely. First of all, thank you for inviting me to participate in your podcast, something I've never done.
Of course.
And as Chris stated, I have literally been in the transportation and logistics industry for more than 40 years, 41 to be exact. My current position is Vice President of Business Development for Ryder Systems Supply Chain Services, their dedicated transportation solutions group.
It's a mouthful.
Yeah. It doesn't fit well on a business card.
So I kind of want to start from the beginning, and I know obviously you've had a long history. So can you tell us real quick where you're from Arizona, where you got where you went to college initially, and kind of give us a snapshot of that experience and then how you transitioned out and into Ryder?
Sure. Well, typically that's a pretty straightforward question that people can answer with a pretty much short sentence. In my case, I was attending Arizona State University and studying what was simply called business transportation, and it was part of the business school curriculum there at the university. The term logistics had not yet been introduced into the transportation world. So it was just business transportation. During that time, Ryder had reached out to their leasing customers, which included my family, searching for an individual to serve as a college internship, actually the first one that they ever initiated. I interviewed and I got the internship, probably because of my family. But anyways, that's another story.
So you were one of their first interns ever?
To the best of my knowledge, I was the first intern that they ever hired directly from college. They've since, it's
really
part of their normal recruiting process.
Right.
But yeah, I was the first one that I'm aware of back in 1978.
Wow, that's cool. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Your family was in the trucking world and you kind of grew up in it a little bit.
Absolutely. I was around trucks my entire life. So it, second nature, it just made sense, studying transportation, thinking of going into work for the family business, but really didn't know what I was going to do. So this was a great opportunity for me to look outside of the family business and, get involved with Ryder, which at the time was, a growing company.
Right. Right. And, I'm sure it was a lot, different back then. And so you actually didn't finish your degree at ASU?
No, actually I did not. Between my junior and senior years, I was offered a full-time position with Ryder and thus began what ended up as a 30-year career. I never got the degree. And to this day, when asked about it during interviews and conversations, my answer has always been the same. And that's, why do we send our kids to college? Is it to take classes? Is it to get a piece of paper? Or is it to get a good job? And ultimately, of course, I got a great job. It lasted for a long time and plenty of on the job training that and experience that could really never have been matched in any classroom.
Right. And do you think, well, I guess it sounds like you kind of got the Ryder connection initially because of your family, not necessarily because of Arizona State.
Yeah, exactly. It was because my family was a leasing customer of Ryder's, and they were reaching out to them first. And so that gave me a leg up on the competition, so to speak.
Right. No, I mean, that's an honor. Obviously, they had enough respect for your family's business, so...
Yeah, they obviously were paying the bills.
Right. And so how did you make the jump, and did they just say, hey, Mark, we want to offer you a full-time job, you can start now? And then it was just the rest is history?
Yeah, they really came to me there in the summer between my junior and senior years and said, hey, we're making some changes here in Phoenix. We like what you're doing. And we would like you to become our district rental manager, which at the time was a very good job in the company. They don't have it, so to speak, anymore, that position. But at the time, it was a very good job. It actually paid more than graduating engineers from ASU's engineering school. And so I was delighted to take it on.
Gotcha. So it sounds like you're not one of those, I have people I've interacted with that are, almost they're one extreme or the other. People are like pro college, get your master's degree right away. And then there's people that are like, oh, college is dumb, trade schools, all that. It sounds like you're not necessarily against college, but just kind of know what it is a tool for ultimately.
Yeah, and having put three daughters through college,
that must have been cheap.
I sort of understand it, and I go both ways on the subject. I mean, it really depends what somebody wants to do. Most of my girls went towards education, so they're teachers, mm-hmm. There are certainly some some good points to go to school to learn about how to deal with personalities and how to teach children and things like that. But yeah, I think everyone's situation is different. And I really, really still to this day believe that. I don't believe that everybody needs to have a college degree. If they're willing to work hard, and it's just not for everybody.
Right. No, absolutely. I think it depends too, like you said, on, you know, what your pursuit is. Obviously, if you want to become a doctor, yes, that's one thing. But
if you wanna, I prefer they have some education. Yeah.
Right. If you want to write poetry, then maybe just a journal or something.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
So you started in the rental kind of world with Ryder. Just maybe walk us through a quick snapshot of your work history and staying in the trucking industry. I know it was kind of, sequential. You worked your way up the ladder and had some twists and turns in between, but I think we can all kind of learn from that if you want to give us a snapshot of that.
Yeah, so, 30 years with Ryder, you're absolutely right, had a lot of twists and turns, a lot of great opportunities. From the rental counter when I was studying and going to school, to outside lease sales, to rental management, and then outside lease sales, national sales. And ultimately, I attained the position of vice president of national sales for the Western division of Ryder, the Western area of Ryder. Again, that was a 30 years where I spent time both on the, we call it fleet management side, or the truck rental and leasing side, most people would recognize it as well as the supply chain side, various sales capacities and leadership roles, mainly on the sales side in both divisions. At 49, I was a 30-year employee. I started when I was 19, and I was given the opportunity to explore other options, including what retirement might look like. And it was a good time for me. It was after 30 years, I was ready for that. Same company, 30 years long, lots of ups and downs, lots of pros and cons, mostly pros, very few cons. But I was ready to start a different chapter in my life. Retirement wasn't going to work. My mind and my body were not ready for that. Still not ready for that.
It's too early, huh?
Yeah. I went to work for Supply Chain Solutions, a warehousing and transportation management provider, as president of their West Coast operations for a couple of years. But I quickly tired of that commute from Phoenix to Los Angeles every week. So I stuck it out for a couple of years, but it just wasn't that exciting. It wasn't something that I really enjoyed. Part of that being that it wasn't the culture I was used to at Ryder. So then I turned to a little bit of a retirement, sat back, tried to decide, and an amazing opportunity. I was offered a consulting role in a business startup in Johannesburg, South Africa, for an American company working with South Africa Breweries, which is the parent company to Miller Beer, and Coca-Cola, which over there is called Amalgamated Beverages. And they were looking to westernize or reinvent their fleet management and maintenance processes. And that's what I was over there helping them do. I was actually helping start up the business for the American company, making banking arrangements, vendor arrangements, hiring employees, interviewing. It was just an amazing opportunity and experience that I was able to share with my wife, Robin, and travel all around South Africa and learning about the culture. And everything that went on there. Ultimately, I stepped aside from that consulting role when it was near completion, but they had very strict immigration policies, and it required every 90 days for you to fly back to the United States.
Oh, wow.
and have your passport stamped at the South African Embassy in Los Angeles.
Gotcha.
And that's a 17-hour flight.
Oh, yeah.
Just from Johannesburg to Atlanta, and then you add on the flight to L.A., and I just couldn't take it anymore. I just said, you know, we're almost done. I'm not going back this time. So
how were you there? Just the 3 months?
No, I was there almost a year.
Okay, so you did do it a couple times.
Yeah. And I just couldn't do it anymore. The good thing is that upon returning to the United States, it really re-energized me, that I wanted to get back into the corporate world, that I liked working with the big companies, South Africa Breweries and Coca-Cola there. I liked the structure. I liked the, everything that went on in that environment. And so came back and started looking and landed a job with Schneider National, big over-the-road truckload LTL carrier, mainly a truckload carrier, running their or starting up their dedicated business on the West Coast. But unfortunately, very shortly after, they were hit with a massive lawsuit, one of the largest at the time. Settlement against a trucking company for it wasn't even a fatality, but it was a serious accident.
Oh, wow.
And they made the decision and have since executed on it to exit California. All their dedicated operations were moved, just shut down over there, and they moved all of their drivers and all of their assets actually to Phoenix. So there wasn't going to be a lot going on the West Coast. So I stepped aside on that role after talking with the CEO of Schneider. And that's when I went into my midlife crisis, as my wife calls it, and literally got my CDL and hit the road. I'd had a CDL for a long time during my tenure at Ryder, and I let it lapse. But I went back just because I wanted to experience what life of the over-the-road trucker was really like, since I spent so much of my life selling those services. I wanted to really understand how the hours of service impacted drivers, how the electronic logging devices would impact their lives, how they just how they survived out on the road.
Right, you wanted to kind of get in the trenches.
Yeah. So I did that for almost a year, and I really enjoy driving. So that was not, it was like camping in a truck.
Did you have a dedicated truck you were tied to?
I had a variety of different leasing trucks, which was interesting alone, because we all know the one thing trucks do consistently is they break down.
Right.
It doesn't matter where they're from or who makes them or anything. They're going to break down. They're mechanical devices. But what I learned when you're out over the road, it's not a Ryder or a Penske or a National Lease mechanic that comes and fixes you over the road. It's the same guy that contracts his services out to all of the different vendors,
right,
via their 800 RoadNet services. So
Joe's Tire Shop or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was an interesting experience. One that certainly wasn't, it's not for everybody, and it wasn't for me. I have a great deal of respect for drivers. I think they're severely underpaid for the responsibility that we task them with.
Right.
But, you know, that has changed a little bit, but I would say not in proportion to maybe other sectors, other jobs. But anyways, it was another great life experience nonetheless. So.
Right. Then, no, that's neat that you got to see that side of it, you know.
Yeah. And shortly after that, I met you at Rush Truck Rental and Leasing. And while I was driving, they actually reached out to me, having heard I was driving a truck, and wondered if I would be interested in coming to work for them and helping them develop a new Denver location, which ultimately you ended up running. So I was with Rush for about 5 years when an opportunity arose at Vanguard Truck Centers to become their corporate director of lease and rental. They are a quickly growing and expanding Mack and Volvo dealership across the country. And that, again, was a great time to get in and learn the Mack and Volvo side as far as it relates to their products and, you know, the Mack story of in America, built here in America in 100 years, and a great truck, a great company to work for. And things were going really well. And I think that's when strange things happened, because suddenly, after 2 years, the circle closed when Ryder asked me, would I ever consider coming back? And obviously, having spent 30 years with Ryder, they have a near and irregardless of what happens in this current role, you know, Ryder will always have a place in my heart. I raised my family with their help, they will always have a special place in my soul. And, you know, they made me an offer this go around that I couldn't refuse. So here we are, full circle.
No, that's neat. And obviously, like you said, a variety of roles and twists and turns. And I think it's kind of neat that you were able to, I don't know, during that driving time and going to South Africa, you're able to kind of do some different things. You were obviously, you know, not necessarily needed a spark, but needed to see a different side of it, if you will, you know, and now you're back at Ryder after all. So it's funny how everything works out. But what's kept you in trucking this long? Obviously it has to be an industry that you enjoy, and what is the driving force behind that?
Well, that's a real easy answer, maybe a little too simple, but really it's the people. You know, throughout my career, that's the one thing that has remained constant: the support of my peers and people that I worked with over the years, many of whom have had ties to Ryder in one form or another throughout their careers. So just knowing people throughout the industry has allowed me to, successfully transition, move on, check other things out, and ultimately come back. But it's always been related to somebody who has known me from early Ryder days and says, hey, we need to reach out to this guy.
Right.
And so that's the simple answer. The people have kept me into it, and I still feel that way about it today.
I remember, you know, I don't work in the trucking industry anymore, but just when I did and when I was working with you, just how small seeming of a community the rental and leasing, especially industry, which is, you know, essentially an industry within an industry, but was, you know, and obviously Ryder has a huge sphere of influence in that world, but it was pretty fascinating to see how many people knew each other, even if they're on, you know, different sides of the country. So it's definitely, you always want to keep good relationships with people too, because you never know when you'll run into them. But
absolutely, your paths will cross.
Exactly. Yeah, you never know what connections will come back up. So what? Trucking is suffering from, you know, a driver shortage, and you know, a lot of industries are suffering from, you know, lack of manpower, labor shortage. Why would you recommend to young people to get into the trucking industry? Why would that be a good choice for them? And not that they necessarily have to be a driver, but just getting into the trucking industry as a whole.
Well, I would ask them to think about it. Think about, if you bought it, a truck brought it. I mean, it's that simple. Everything that we buy as consumers, and I don't care if you're buying it online or at a store, if you're buying something, a truck has touched it. And that's not going away anytime soon, despite a lot of rhetoric about carbon footprints, drone deliveries, and the like. autonomous vehicles, you still have to move as much tonnage as efficiently as possible to keep your costs down. And while electric and hydrogen vehicles are in the works, the economics are just not scalable anytime certainly within my working career, right. As I see it. As a matter of fact, we probably won't see the true mass production of either one of those probably till at least 2025 or 2030. And then, you know, they've got to get the scalability down. They've got to get the economics down, and they've got to prove proof of concept. But the remaining thing is goods have to move. They have to move from ports to the DCs, from the DCs to the retailer or to an intermediary DC. It depends on the network, but product has to move, and you got to move a lot of it. Otherwise, it's too expensive. So trucks aren't going away anytime soon.
No, and that's a great point. And I think people fail to realize that how essential and in the background, you know, the trucking industry and infrastructure is. I remember I met a representative with Rush at a career fair in college, and that was my first interaction. And I asked him, you know, one of my goals would be to work for a company and a job where I feel like I have some sort of a purpose. And I said, you know, what's the purpose of the trucking industry? And he very succinctly and simply kind of said, you know, we're helping people make a living that are, you know, in the trenches of the trucking industry. But then kind of what you said too, you know, everyone else, consumers in America, depend on these trucks to get everyday items. I remember, I think it was Exxon or something, but they had a commercial about an egg being cracked for breakfast or something, but then they ran it in reverse and showed all the processes it took to get that egg to the breakfast table. And it was amazing. And obviously trucking is a big part of that, getting from one place to the other. But no, that's, and people don't think about that, you know.
We take it for granted that you saw it online, you bought it, and it showed
right.
up.
Yeah, we don't know.
You went into the grocery store, and they have 15 different sizes and colors of that shirt you're looking for. You know, they're
right.
all there, and but we take that for granted. We really do, and we don't understand the what happens in the back room and in the warehouses and in the docks and how that all moves through this country.
And, right, right. Now talk a little bit about how companies can attract talent to the trucking industry. I know we talked about, you know, the industry as a whole, but I mean, there's a lot of upcoming technology and, you know, basically when I was in college, everyone wanted to work for Google and Facebook and Amazon, and that was the trendy thing. You know, everyone wanted to be some sort of marketing something or other for a tech company, if you will. But how can trucking or companies in the trucking world like Ryder attract top young talent?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and having come back to Ryder really kind of allows me to answer that a little more futuristically, if you will. Because that's a rapidly changing landscape in the transportation and logistics industry. And Ryder and some of the other big companies are at the forefront of really capturing all of the big data and technology advances to play a greater role in understanding and streamlining supply chains. So it's very computerized, the distribution networks now. I mean, there's today we're witnessing developments as it relates to telematics, shipment visibility, 100% shipment visibility wherever that truck is. Trucks are getting pinged 3 times a minute, you know, or every second. So, you know, really in real time, exactly where that truck is, where that driver is, where that shipment is. Autonomous vehicles and robotics. You know, we're platooning trucks around the United States where there's a driver in one, two without drivers and a driver in the following truck. And we're actually running those in certain corridors and certain lanes, testing
really?
That technology. Yeah.
Wow.
And then we're using a lot of robotics in our warehousing operations. We're taking inventory with drones that
wow.
that fly through the building and scan everything, scan all the barcodes, and you know they do it like exponentially faster than humans can do it.
And they're autonomous once they're programmed.
Yeah. And they dock themselves. They're programmed to take off at a certain time during the day and come back to their dock and sit back down and recharge itself. We're using skeletal robotics on a lot of our employees to help with lifting mechanisms. It almost looks like, and I'm not a big sci-fi guy, but it looks like some of those Terminator movies or things like that, where these guys, they actually have skeletal sleeves like that support your arms. So if you lift this way, it helps your arms lift. It actually is mechanized and to help people, you know, with lifting heavy objects and things. It is quite amazing where we're going. I just hope we don't eliminate all the jobs.
Right. I know people always bring that up, but obviously innovation breeds new jobs. So, you know.
Yeah, it does. It breeds the technology. It breeds the people behind the technology, which brings
right.
those people into the transportation and logistics people or raises our requirements level. We need those people now so we can actually take them to a warehouse or take them to a facility where we're doing this and show them, hey, look at this. You can play with this drone.
Yeah.
You can program drones all day, you know, and things of that nature. So it's amazing. And coming back to Ryder, I've seen a lot of it firsthand because we're testing all sorts of different technologies today, handheld devices and things like that. I mean, we've all seen them with FedEx and everything, but they're so much more powerful than just getting a proof of delivery today.
Right. Right. Wow. Yeah. I'll have to, I'd love to see some of that. That's amazing. So moving on to kind of focusing on your sales skills and that aspect of your career, obviously you've had a lot of success and, you know, moved up in responsibilities over the years. You have done some big deals with, you know, noteworthy brands, Kroger, the LA Times, more than that, obviously, as well. But what do you attribute your success in selling to, and what advice would you give to young salespeople?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we get all the credit for our success, and we also get all the credit for our failure. It really is a team effort in the transportation logistics industry, especially when you're selling, you know, maintenance services, finance packages, warehousing and distribution technology and distribution methodology, network optimization. There's a whole team that is behind the scenes, and really our role is in everything is to be kind of the team quarterback, to make sure that we're listening to the customer and that everyone is focused on their responsibility as it relates to solving the customer's problem. If you're not trying to solve the customer's problem, you're wasting your time because they have to have a problem that you're trying to solve.
Absolutely.
And, if they're just even keel and they're happy with the way things are, then don't waste your time. Move on. Find somebody who's either growing, and usually they're in some sort of trouble, but that trouble needs to be related to growth. They're opening new markets. They're expanding. If it's trouble because they're losing customers, that's a whole different issue. And,
right.
and you probably don't want to be involved in that one.
Yeah, spare yourself.
Yeah, it's trouble usually associated with growth and expansion, where they need to reach beyond their and they need somebody to come in and solve that challenge for them because they don't have the expertise, they don't have the reach, they don't have the, they don't even have the employees, the scope to cover the growth.
Right. And I think that's important to remember, me especially, you learn the hard way sometimes, just the opportunity costs of wasting your time on a bad prospect or a, deal that has 2% chance of closing. You know what I mean? It's like if you, you were active. Yeah, you checked some of the boxes, but in reality, if that wasn't anything that was going to turn into anything, you could have been using your time a lot more efficiently. And I think for me as a salesperson, that's a constant battle because, especially in today's day and age, you get distracted so easily with so many different forms of communication and things like that. So it's almost like you want to call on everyone, but really you can't. So, get a little bit more of a efficient game plan. So.
Yeah, you got to be more of a, instead of a shotgun, you got to use a rifle.
Yeah, that's a good one. I'm going to steal that. So, so this is a good segue. When I worked with you, I know you mentioned it, and I'd love for you to shed some more light on it and give us some details. But you worked with another gentleman that you and I have interacted with, Jim Browning, in a deal that was a multi-million dollar deal. And essentially, you guys put a ton of effort into it, and it didn't go the way you planned. Can you share that story with us and how you bounced back from that lost deal?
It's funny that you asked about that particular story. I was recently going through some old files, and I found that presentation file. And you're correct. It was with Jim.
So you still have it, huh?
I still have it. I actually looked at it today again, too.
Wow.
Jim was a national account manager for a large medical scanning company, nationwide company, that was headquartered in Southern California. And really, they were struggling with the challenges related to drivers, equipment utilization, acquisition, fueling, scheduling their imaging trailers to move on a regular schedule to these hospitals, just having that kind of technology so that they didn't have too many trucks, they didn't have too many trailers, and the whole nine yards around that. And we had direct access to the CEO, CFO, and all of the data surrounding their operations. Now, back in those days, most of the data was not in they didn't hand you a stick and say,
right,
here's everything we've done for the last 24 months. They handed you volumes of paper that basically said, here's what we're spending. Here's how we did it. Here's what our schedule was for this month, that month. And we had to literally go through all of that, all of that information to come up with the solution to their operations. Now, we had just completed an advanced sales training class in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and decided that we were going to put what we learned to test. It sounded good. We took the class. It was a week long. So we were going to step outside our comfort zone, if you will, and give them a whole new presentation format and a whole new way of presenting Ryder. And so we set up the conference room exactly like we were told to set it up. We set up this, it was a $24 million opportunity, and our presentation was only 12 pages long. But it was all focused on our ability and how we could save them 16% on their transportation costs year after year. And it was all done perfectly. It was all about, here's the steps we took, here's where you're at, here's where we're at. It talked nothing about, Ryder or what we do. It says, here's what we're going to do for you. Here's how we're going to solve your problem, and we're going to save you a ton of money.
How long did it take you to prepare that?
Oh, my God. We probably worked, it was probably 90 days at least to go through all the data. We had our own engineer in our office at that time. And actually, we had reached out to to some people in Ryder because we knew it was going to be a big deal. And they're like, ah, you'll never get that. And so then all of a sudden we got a call from Miami, and one of the vice presidents go, what are you and Jim Browning working on? And I said, well, we're working on this imaging deal, and it's about $25 million. Why doesn't anybody know about this? Well, we tried. Nobody wanted to play.
Nobody wanted to play.
And they, well, why didn't you run it up? We ran it as far as we could. You know, David, I don't usually call you, you know?
Right.
And I said, well, I'm coming out for this presentation. So we did this presentation, and David was blown away as well. He'd never seen anything like it before. We had a very interactive meeting. We even set up the seating arrangements in the meeting like they had told us in the class, so that you separated people and had people sit next to each other you wanted that could maybe influence that person. It was very cool.
Wow, very in-depth.
So we walked away from that meeting thinking, we got this. We got this. The CEO loves it. The CFO loves it. About 2 days later, we get a call from the president of our division, and he goes, guys, got bad news. We didn't get that Alliance deal. And we're like, what? How do you know? And he goes, here's what happened. The CEO of the Alliance Imaging actually called the CEO of Ryder and told him that it was the best presentation he'd ever seen in his entire career, and that it made so much sense. But as a company, they just culturally, he just couldn't sell it across all the different regions nationwide, and all the change that would be felt by those regions.
Right.
He really wanted to do it, but he had surveyed his regional vice presidents and his regional presidents, and they just all said, "Now we can't go along with that, or we're not having that problem here." You know, nobody admits they're having the problem.
Right.
And they were a very decentralized decision making firm, but they were headquartered in Southern California. So we got a call from Greg Swinton, who was the CEO, congratulating us on doing such a great job. we got a feather in our cap, but no money in our bank account.
Right. Did your heart sink? How did you react to move on from there after that? Obviously, it's nice to get a call and compliment from the CEO, but
it didn't sink only because we knew we did the best that we could do, and we knew that we had the right solution. The fact that they couldn't implement it, you just sometimes can't control that. Looking back on it today, maybe that's something we could have vetted a lot earlier and not spent so much time on. But we really thought we had a solid solution because of the savings. But it was too big for them to too big a challenge for them to take on.
Right. So
they're still a customer of Ryder's today.
Oh wow!
And they're still just as inefficient as they were then.
Yeah. Man, what a story, though. Gosh, I'm sure you learned a lot from that. I mean, I think that's why it's important to have long-term vision just in life and in your career, because you can't, especially in sales, you can't, you got to take things in stride, and you got to move on, and, there's another deal somewhere else that you got to uncover. So that would have been a hard pill to swallow, I can imagine, but...
Yeah.
Now, I remember when we were working together, you once told me, and I've always remembered it, you once said, don't listen to anybody, and it was in the context of basically, especially sometimes industry veterans have biases, and people that have been in a specific, like, geographic market, in a specific industry, they have their biases on what's what and who's who. And you encouraged me. I was, super green, barely knew anything about trucks, barely knew anything about sales, and you just encouraged me to go out there and don't listen to anybody. And can you elaborate on, you know, the true meaning of what you're saying and how salespeople can take that to heart?
Yeah, it really goes back to relationships and timing. You know, so many times we hear just what you said, that, oh, that company never buys anything, you're wasting your time, and only to discover that something or someone has changed in that organization or that company, and you missed an opportunity. They bought from somebody else because you had a preconceived notion that or got some bad advice from a seasoned person. You can't take anything for granted. You got to knock on the door. You got to ask for the business. You got to introduce yourself. I mean, what's the worst thing that can happen? Is they say no.
Right.
At least you had a chance to make an introduction, to begin a relationship, to drop off a business card, and to show some interest in their business. And the best thing that you may discover that something that gets you a deal, because it, look at yourself. You're on your second job back there right now. People change, and more so than ever in today's world, people are changing. Companies are changing. They're reinventing themselves. They're downsizing.
Right.
They're right sizing, whatever they call it. They're always trying to do more with less. So it's important that you stay in touch with your market and don't let anybody influence your work effort because they didn't have success. You know, the Los Angeles Times, which we sold, I must have heard it 25 times in that sales process. We quote this every year and they're never going to change. Well, guess what? That year they changed.
Wow.
And we won the deal. So for 20 years, they never did anything. They always looked at it, but they had a compelling event. They had a change in leadership. They had a change in management that said, we're going to make a change. And I was there because I had made the contact, and we got the deal.
Wow. No, that's awesome. You want your card to be on top, right? So
yeah.
No, that's, and you're right. People do business with people. And if you're the person that comes to mind, you know, when an opportunity arises, then who knows where it could go. So now you've moved a lot geographically. Obviously you move positions, but in your career, how did you handle the transitions, and especially just on a personal level with your family and the, you know, career changes and home life?
Well, you know, my family, as you know, has been my motivating factor in everything that we've done. And, you know, I have the pleasure of having a very supportive partner and best friend for 43 years now, my wife, Robin. And, you know, my career and the changes that we've made has really allowed her to stay at home and raise the kids and be a homemaker. Though I would never take that job.
it's tough. My wife does the
Believe
same. So.
That is no easy task. And, you know, we moved pretty regularly. But the kids were always, you know, they were and at different ages during their life, but they always saw it as kind of a good thing. You know, we always tried to position it as a good thing. We're moving here for a new experience. You're going to meet new friends. And because they had done it before, I think there was less fear. I see a lot of people just afraid to make that initial move, just to make it happen. They get stuck in a rut, and then before they know it's too long, and they're like, oh, my kid's in high school, you know, all these kids. Well, we started moving early and often, about every 5 years for different roles. And the kids realized that they're going to meet somebody. So fortunately, it worked out well for the most part. And, you know, we always had one rule that we followed whenever we did move. And I think it helped us out a lot, is we always knew we weren't going to buy someplace the first minute we got to town. We were going to rent for a year, decide, did we pick the right city? Did we pick the right schools? Did we pick the right neighborhood? Usually we did, but it really allowed us to keep our bearings. I see so many people who get so caught up in the house hunting trip, and they got to buy a house. They buy a house, and then they're miserable. Their wife's miserable. The kids are miserable because they hate being there. And we never made that mistake. So I've told a lot of young people, you know, don't get caught up in I got to buy a house trap. Rent for a while and find out, is this going to be right for you? Is this where you want to be? Is this the right city, the right neighborhood, the right schools? And that worked well for us.
Right. It almost helps you mitigate some of the risk of moving, you know, because you kind of have that get out of jail option, or you can just move locally, you know, to a different neighborhood. So I think that's practical piece of advice for sure.
We usually did that. We either moved within a mile or so because we liked the schools and we liked the town that we picked, but we found a better neighborhood. And so we bought in the better neighborhood or where we felt more comfortable, or kids had more friends over that way, that type of thing. But it allowed us to, you know, at least evaluate the landscape a little bit before we dove right in. And we didn't have too many regrets about, you know, moving. And we moved from Phoenix to San Francisco, San Francisco to Chicago, Chicago to LA, and then back to Phoenix.
Okay. Yeah. So not a crazy amount, but still definitely did your fair share. I think it's interesting too.
Years.
Yeah. Right. You had a schedule, right?
Yeah.
I think it's interesting too, because, you know, my wife and I have moved from, since we've been married, Phoenix to Denver, Denver to now we live in New Hampshire. And it almost, the more you move, the more you exercise your moving muscles, and you almost, like you said, you get almost comfortable with taking that leap of faith. You know, we don't have plans to move anytime soon. We just got here, but it almost is less scary if the opportunity presents itself. So I remember working with you and just respecting the fact that you were willing to do some not unimportant tasks, but kind of meager, menial tasks that weren't necessarily part of your role as a manager, you know, and those would include, you know, delivering trucks, doing pickup and drop off paperwork, washing trucks from time to time. Why were doing these things important to you as a leader, and how can, you know, managers of people learn from an example like that?
You know, you lead by example, first and foremost. So we were fortunate when we worked together. We had a pretty loose arrangement. We could do just about anything we wanted to do as long as it got done.
Right. Yeah. I appreciate the autonomy, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. That I don't have that nearly as much in the big company structure as we did there at Rush. But, you know, there is no job too small or too menial. There are certainly some jobs, you know, that I'm not qualified to do, like fixing a truck, but I can, you know, certainly change the oil and fix a flat. Not that I've ever had to do that on a truck or anything, but I can do it. And, you know, it just is that lead by example, because people see those little things. People, not just like somebody in, like yourself, another manager, but the guys in the shop, the guys, you know, out on the fuel island, the guys who are just around, even some of the vendors that are around, they see that you're willing to do that and go the extra mile. And, you know, it impacts them. It affects them as well. So when you ask them to do something that's maybe out of the scope of what they're used to doing, they're more acceptable of, okay, he did it, I can do it. That's not his job, but he did it. So I can do something. I can give that little bit extra. I think that's important. I still, to this day, when I'm out and we're in like Fresno or someone, and we have a big customer we're going to go see, I'll ask, do they have any trucks that are in the shop that need to be delivered back? And I'll take them.
That's so awesome.
Yeah. So I get some really strange looks from the just out of college guys who go, what? Huh? What? No, we're going to ride in my car. Well, if they got a truck that needs to go back, rather than then bring a driver here, let's take it to them.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
It's just one of those things I've always done. So maybe why Ryder hired me when I was in college to begin, why they offered me the job.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You never know. And you're right. You do have to lead by example, and you know, all the, you know, military examples of the guys fighting in the heat of battle,
yeah,
with their troops, things like that. You know, it's just like, you can apply it to so many different aspects of life, so many different industries. It's like, it's hard to ask people to do something if you're not willing to do it. So no, that's good. And like I said, that's always stuck out in my mind. So as you worked through your career, you know, you always obviously valued your job and wanted to be successful and were successful, but it stood out to me that your life wasn't fully consumed by work. And yeah, you put in the extra time when you had to, but family was obviously a huge priority. How did you balance your work life, your home life, and not fall into the workaholic culture that some of us fall into here in America?
Yeah, it certainly, you know, was a balancing act for sure. Probably early on in my career, it was more about me and the job than I probably even realized or recognized. And then as the kids grew and they made sacrifices moving and whatnot for me, it became more about them and how do we as a family enjoy our times together? How do we carve out that quality time? And that became very, very important. You know, the work to live, not live to work motto has always been a favorite mantra of mine. And being flexible and valuing the needs and beliefs of others and what they need to make it work in their life has always been important to me. I know you and I have talked about that quite a bit. But it also, you know, it builds friendships, it builds trust, and it builds teamworks. And, you know, we can't do any of this alone by ourselves. We certainly have to make time for those that are helping us out professionally and personally in our lives. And it's not all about work. I had a friend, a writer in my first 30 years who said the key to being successful is make it look like you're not working. Always get it done, but make it look like you're not working. So I don't know really what that means, but I've always tried to do that. I always tried to keep a neat desk. I always tried to keep things organized and filed away and do one, you know, finish a task before I start another task. And I think that's always kind of kept me on task and has allowed me to kind of live that balance a little bit better.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, especially, I mean, multitasking. I mean, there's so many studies that show that multitasking is so inefficient in most circumstances. And I think focus and just focusing and kind of breaking yourself off from the many communications of this world is a lost art nowadays, for sure.
Now, yeah, I think we all suffer that one.
Well, yeah, and it's hard not to when you have emails dinging at you from your phone and your computer. I mean, there's so many different ways.
Yep.
So when it comes to your career and you look back, and, you know, I know obviously you're still working and, you know, coming towards the end of your career, would you go back and change anything specifically? And if so, what?
You know, I thought a lot about this question. Probably not. You know, I'm extremely grateful for all that we've been blessed with, our family, our friends, our health, happiness, and to some degree prosperity. I think we're pretty successful. I don't think I would change a thing for fear of messing with one of those very messing it up. So I have to stick with now.
Well, that's neat. I mean, not everyone can say that, right? So that's very cool. Very cool.
Yeah. You know, if I'd done anything different, maybe I wouldn't have met my wife, you know.
Say that again.
That's always my, if I'd changed something early on, gone to the military, you know, some of the things you think about military service and some of the things that I think are very, very important that I didn't experience, you know, would that change what my wife? And you know, so I just can't change anything because I just love everything. We're so blessed as a family that I don't want to mess up. I don't want to mess up the universe.
Now, what part, or I'm sorry, what is one piece of parting advice that you would give to someone listening today that might be starting out, you know, coming out of high school or coming out of college, or maybe they're even in the middle of their careers and just looking for a spark or a change or inspiration? What piece of career advice would you give to them?
Be devoted. Be committed. Have your goals, short-term and long-term. Keep them updated. You're not going to hit them off, but, you know, if you're doing your job and you're working hard at it, if you're devoted and you're determined, the three Ds, dedication, devotion, and determination, if you got those, all the rest of that stuff will come.
Hey everyone, I hope you enjoyed the show. One of my main takeaways from this talk is Mark's suggestion to salespeople to use a rifle and not a shotgun approach. This is a strategy that I've tried to apply to my own sales life, and I think we can all learn from being more thoughtful in the prospects that we target as salespeople. So I hope you enjoyed today's conversation. We'll see you next time. Hey everyone, one way you can support the show is by checking out our new affiliate partner, Lone Birch Company, based out of New Hampshire, where I am as well. Their owner and founder, Jarek, actually did an interview with me. His episode may or may not be out, depending on when you're listening to this, but go check them out and use the coupon code CAREER for 10% off. They make wood, handmade wood products for your desk or office setting. So check them out. Super high quality stuff, and it'll help Jarek's business and the show. Thanks.